Macworld Podcast number 231 for February 16th, 2011. Welcome to another Macworld Podcast. I'm Chris Breen. In this episode, we cover two topics. First, Macworld Associate Editor David Chartier and I discuss Apple's recently unveiled App Store subscription plan, how this plan will affect both App Store customers and the people who provide content via the store. I'm then joined by Julio Ojeda Zapata, a reporter for the St. Paul Pioneer Press, to discuss the iPad in business. Now, to subscriptions and the App Store. I'm joined by Macworld Associate Editor David Chartier to talk about Apple's long-awaited launch of subscriptions for the App Store. Thanks very much for being here, David.
Thanks a lot for having me back, Chris.
So on Tuesday, Apple announced that indeed the publishing industry would get subscriptions. So exactly how does this work?
This works fairly similar to what we've seen for regular app pricing. Publishers can charge any kind of subscription they want, weekly, monthly, yearly, what have you. And the publisher gets to keep 70%. Apple takes 30% if the customer decides to subscribe through the app. However, the one difference is that if a publisher signs up a subscriber on their own, say they do it from their website or they send offers to current subscribers of, say, a print edition, the publisher gets to keep 100% of whatever their subscription fee is. So there's the little bit of difference.
Okay, so let me get this straight. So I'm subscribing to some publication. I do it through the publication's website, and I can still download this from the App Store or from the iBook Store.
Yes, you can. Apple's announcement isn't entirely specific about how that works, but I would imagine it's based on some kind of a login. Say you sign up at the New York Times or what have you, you create a login with the name and the password. You can probably use that in the app. The app will recognize who you are and grant access to all that content, and the publisher gets to keep, you know, 100% of what they charge.
Okay. So let's say I'm the New York Times or some fictitious publication, and I'd say, aha, I see that Apple is charging $10 per week for this publication, and they're going to take 30%. How about if I charge $8 on my site and I get 100%? So better for me, right?
Unfortunately, that would be better for you, yes. But unfortunately, Apple's rules do not allow for that. Publishers need to keep the prices either the same between the website and the App Store, or the price must be lower in the App Store. You can't kind of adjust for those costs and try to entice users to sign up through you.
Right. So this is different than the Mac App Store, where a developer can charge anything they like, and it can be different from what the App Store charges.
Yeah, it is a little bit different than that. Apple is basically just wants to they want to get their cut for bringing a new subscriber to a publisher. They want to get their share of the pie for providing that simple experience of downloading the app and hitting a button and subscribing and creating that kind of convenience and sort of that marketing opportunity for the publishers.
Okay. Now there's this other element of personal information. What's that all about?
So something that Apple is very protective of is our personal information, and it's something they probably don't get quite as much recognition for. But publishers obviously want to know who we are. They want to know our names and our age and a little bit of demographic information. And Apple has been pretty resilient against handing that over. But with this announcement, they've ceded a little bit of ground to the publishers, and now when you sign up for each publication, you will have the option to give some of your personal information to the publisher, and that'll be your name, your zip code, and I believe your age.
Okay. Now, is that an opt-in or opt-out?
That is one thing I'm trying to find out. I haven't heard back from Apple yet, but one way or the other, it will be on a per-publisher basis. So whether the box will already be checked or you'll have to uncheck it or what, we're not sure of, but it'll be per publisher as you subscribe.
Okay. Well, I did try the subscription option for the daily, at least their free one.
And I understood that this was part of it, is that they were going to have the option to ask me for personal information. But I never saw any option there that told me one way or the other. And I'm not sure if it just hasn't been implemented or I just haven't found it yet.
This might be one of those new territories that Apple is going to kind of have to one of those new bridges that Apple is going to have to build as we come to it. The Daily, of course, was News Corp's app that was sort of the first. It seemed kind of like a trial run that News Corp released earlier this month, and Apple was kind of a partner because they sort of introduced this subscription feature there. So I think that might be something that Apple will have to lay out probably in its developer guidelines. It might be something that Apple will have to say it has to be opt in, I should say. Maybe the users will have to check that box in order to give you your information or what. I'm not sure where they've landed on that side of the fence.
Okay. Reading some of the comments on Twitter and in reaction to your article, I see kind of a split between publishers. Some say, this is great for us. Yes, we're giving up 30% to Apple, but on the other hand, we get a lot more people subscribing because of it. It's an easy avenue for people to doing this. And then other people are outraged that Apple would dare to take 30% and make it more difficult for people to subscribe outside of Apple's environment.
Yeah, there's a lot going on here. One of the rules that I think is causing a lot of the contention is that the app cannot have a link or really a mention at all of being able to go to the publisher's site and subscribe. So our fictitional publication cannot present a screen in the app and say, hey, if you come to our website, it'll make us a lot happier because we'll get to keep more of our subscription fee. You can't. It sort of cannot mention the website in that context at all. So one of the really big questions right now is what this is going to do for someone like the Amazon with their Kindle app, because Amazon takes its chunk out of selling each book through its Kindle store, and adding another 30% on top of that for each book bought inside the Kindle app on an iOS device is probably going to be a little bit too steep of a fee to pay. So that's one of the really big walls that we're running into right now, and we're just going to have to kind of see what happens.
Well, yeah, I saw a comment about that this could extend out to Netflix, Hulu, any of these subscription services. I mean, is the sky falling, or do we simply just not know what Apple has in mind?
Yeah, I think it's a little early to say the sky is falling again, because this announcement just came out this morning, and there are lots of little details that kind of have to be filled in. For example, Netflix is a great app to bring up, because I just checked that this morning. When you download the Netflix app on your device, if you're not already a member, it prompts you to go to the website. You cannot sign up for the Netflix app on the device. So subscribers have to go to the website in a traditional computer and sign up, which would mean that Netflix would get 100% of its subscription fee. Something that Apple has not clarified is whether that will change, whether users will have to be able to sign up for a service like Netflix on the device, in which case it will get its fee. So maybe companies like Netflix, maybe Rhapsody, the music subscription service, will be able to still do that. Say you have to come to our site if you're going to be a new customer, and then that way they can kind of get a little more of their piece of the pie.
Yeah, I think a lot of it is too soon to tell. It's very interesting that Apple is doing this. Have they said anything about advertising, how that's going to work? Is Apple also going to want to insert their own ads into this stuff, or does it seem like they're leaving that alone?
It seems like they've left advertising alone. There's been no mention of advertising in today's announcement. But if you look at the Daily app, which has been using the subscription feature for a little while, there are a few ads in between each of the pages. So it seems like ads are kind of fair game. I'm sure that Apple would be happy if publishers signed up to use iAds, its own advertising service, mm-hmm. in their apps. But it seems like those are going to kind of be up for grabs.
Okay. And finally, in this reaction, I'm hearing kind of more objection than I did to, for example, the music industry, where Apple went in and ate their lunch and nobody seemed to care much. And the movie industry, nobody seems to care about them, or the television industry. And yet this deal, for some reason, has got a lot of people up in arms. Is it simply because people like you and me and other journalists make our living from this, and so we have a voice and are therefore shouting about it? Or is there something different about this?
I think you're right. The reaction is a little bit louder this time around, and I can't quite put my finger on it yet. I think a little bit is that it might feel like the publishing industry isn't in quite as much trouble as the music industry was when the iTunes, back then it was called the iTunes Music Store, first debuted. There's the Kindle app, which has been extremely successful, and Amazon's whole line of Kindle devices, let's say, have been pretty successful. So, but it also, this announcement kind of creates a little bit of trouble for someone like Amazon, because they're basically a middleman for some of these publishers, these books and these magazines. So if people have a large collection built up on Amazon already, what's going to happen with that? If these rules and Apple's subscription fees are too much for the Kindle, is Amazon going to have to pull its app? Are we still going to be able to access the content that we've already purchased? Or is that all just going to shut off? There's a lot of questions that I think remain unanswered. And that, if people are scared of anything lately, I think it's unanswered questions when it comes to this large of an announcement.
Yeah, I think that Apple's take on this, and they haven't said it, but I think generally what they say is, look, we're trying to make this as easy for our customers as possible. And so we don't want them having to go to another website to sign up in order to get content from here. We provide that service. And I think honestly, for most customers, they don't care that 30% is invisible to them. They don't care where their money goes. It's just make it easy for me to subscribe to something. I can get it and I can renew my subscription or I can cancel it easily. And who cares what happens to them? But I do think you're right that there is this danger, particularly in terms of Amazon. If their app can be driven out of the App Store, what is that going to do for Apple? Does that mean Apple gains more control over our content, what we can and can't see?
Right, because that would open, you know, if Apple drives the Kindle out of the App Store, well, there's always iBooks, Apple's own bookstore just waiting for you to start buying through. And that will open up a whole different line of questions and concerns. But I think in the end, one of the always what I feel is sort of an underrated aspect of all this is the amount of convenience that you sort of just touched on that Apple's platforms provide. Apple, I think, just mentioned that they have, I think, over 100 million customers signed up with credit cards ready and waiting in the iTunes store. And the iOS app stores make it so easy to just click a button, type in your password, and buy something and subscribe to it. And I think that convenience is going to win over a lot of customers who are sick of going to every single website to sign up for a service and type in their name and all their information and their credit card yet again. That convenience lowers so many barriers to entry, and I think the success of the App Store and possibly even the much newer Mac App Store kind of speak to that, to what that can do, the doors that can open for developers and now publishers with subscriptions.
Right. I think it also shields Apple from any legal concern later, that if somebody were to say, well, look, Apple's a monopoly here. They said, no, we're not. Actually, you can get this content anywhere you like. We just happen to make it a whole lot easier to get it here. And so that they don't put themselves in a Microsoft-like position, but rather just say, you know, if you want this music, this movie, this TV show, this book, this newspaper, fine, get it somewhere else. You can, but you can't blame us for trying to outcompete our competition by making it easier.
And speaking of competition, Apple, I've been doing some research on this today, and Apple's terms so far seem to be fairly competitive. We keep bringing up Amazon because they're such a good example, but Amazon's terms are very similar. They take 70% out of a publisher's subscription price when they bring a magazine or a newspaper to it. But they also charge a delivery fee because Amazon has that wireless network that they include free with every Kindle, right?
Right.
So they have basically a formula that's based on how large of a file they have to deliver for your publication. And they charge you a few cents for that. So they actually take more out of your subscription fee for each publication that they deliver. And it's even more if you're just an independent blog. Like if you or I had our little blog and we wanted to sign up with Amazon and we weren't an actual publishing, a large enough publishing business, Amazon only hands over 30%. Of the fee that it charges to customers for delivering your blog. So it's, from what I'm seeing so far, Apple is either using fairly standard rates for being sort of a gatekeeper for publishing content like this, or they're actually in a bit better of a position.
interesting story. Well, if you'd like to learn more, check out Tuesday's Apple Launches Long-Awaited Subscriptions for App Store. That was written by our guest, David Chartier. And we'll be covering this story for the days and weeks to come. Thanks very much for being here, David.
Always a pleasure, Chris.
Now the iPad in business. I'm joined by Julio Ojeda Zapata, a writer for St. Paul's Pioneer Press newspaper and author of iPad Means Business, How Apple's Tablet Computer is Changing the Work World. Thanks for being here, Julio.
It's an honor, Chris, since I'm a devoted listener, so it's a pleasure to be on your show.
Well, thanks very much. A lot of people I know have looked at the iPad, and they looked at it when it first came out and thought, what am I going to do with this thing? So what compelled you to think, aha, it's a business tool?
Well, I didn't leap to that conclusion definitively right off the bat. It occurred to me that that might be the case, but when I was casting about for material for my book, I was trying to prove myself that there was enough to go on. I wasn't sure whether the device was really being embraced as a business tool in any significant way. Just a little bit of initial research, you know, put that to rest, because I quickly discovered that companies were embracing the device in droves. So there was plenty to write about.
Okay, so do you personally use your iPad for business?
I use it in tandem. I'm using a MacBook Air right now, and I use the iPad in tandem with that. Like, for instance, if I'm sitting in my office as I am now, it would, in my mind, make absolutely no sense to use the iPad as my primary productivity device. However, if I'm mobile, if I'm out and about, that makes a little more sense. Because I'm probably not going to do massive amount of writing while I'm on the go, but I will do some more limited productivity. If I'm going on a business trip, the likelihood is I would opt for the iPad instead of a laptop. It's lighter, more mobile, and it's simple. When I'm on a trip, I just like to keep things very simple. I like to reduce my complications as much as possible, and the iPad really allows me to do that very elegantly when I'm traveling. And I've figured out how to solve all the problems, how to get all around all of the iPad's limitations when I'm traveling. So it doesn't create a lot of pain for me.
Okay, so yeah, that leads to my next question, because many people wonder if the iPad is a substitute for laptop, and I think it's pretty well been shown that it's not. But what kind of compromises do you have to make so that you can still do business with the iPad?
Well, in my book, for instance, I took a business trip. That business trip was, in fact, to the iPhone 4 unveiling. And I went on a work-related trip for the Pioneer Press. And I sort of asked myself, okay, I'm going on this trip. I usually take a laptop. Should I take the iPad this time? And I decided yes. But I was a little apprehensive, so I just to cover myself, I took two iPads and three Bluetooth keyboards. I just made sure I had, had enough hardware, because I was a little apprehensive about this experiment. I quickly discovered that just for the most part, I was able to accomplish my goals, writing stories, blogging, keeping track of social media, and so on and so forth. I was able to do everything that I needed to do. In many cases, I did it in slightly different ways, but I went on a trip as a reporter to cover this story and use the iPad as my primary productivity device. And it went, for the most part, you know, I had some problems, but for the most part, it went very well, and I would do that again.
Okay, so let's talk about the problems. At what point did you say, oh man, I wish I had my laptop with me?
Well, I'll give you a couple of examples. Like, for instance, Google Docs at the time could not be edited in the browser. Mm-hmm. And this annoyed me to no end, because I live in Google Docs when I'm on a computer. Everything I do in terms of writing and so forth is in Google Docs. I don't use, you know, desktop productivity software like Microsoft Office. I use Google Docs. I couldn't edit my Google Docs in the browser. It just drove me absolutely nuts. And so I did. I switched gears, essentially. I switched over to Simple Note, and found that to be wonderful, because when you're writing in Simple Note, it's backing up to the cloud automatically. If I'm at a later date, if I'm on a computer, I can pull down all that information in notational velocity. And so I found that, you know, very, very handy. I could just do all my writing in Simple Note. In fact, I was at Panera, and, you know, just for giggles, I tried a little experiment. I put both of my iPads in front of me on the table there and typed something in Simple Note, and it backed up to the cloud, and then I had Simple Note on the other iPad, and whoosh, you know, within seconds, the text that I had typed in one iPad appeared on the other iPad, sort of confirming that, you know, indeed my stuff was getting backed up. It was a cool parlor trick. So that was my way to write. And I found that, you know, very satisfactory to the point where I use Simple Note quite often. Like, for instance, when I'm doing a phone interview and I'm typing my notes for the interview, I'll do that in Simple Note on the iPad or in Notational Velocity with Simple Note syncing on the Mac. Let's talk about blogging. Like, when I blog on a Mac, I'll use Mars Edit. If I'm on a PC, I'll use Windows Live Writer, which I adore. Blogging apps for the iPad generally Byte. There's some except Squarespace has a nice app, but generally, you know, blogging apps aren't very good. I just don't like them. But, you know, I found a very elegant way around that. I use Postgres, and Postgres has a fantastic feature where you can post via email. You can type your post, you can attach a couple of photos, email them to a special address, and Postgres very elegantly rearranges everything, formats everything very elegantly, and it's blocked. And I found that to be a very satisfactory solution. However, since I was blogging for the Pioneer Press, the Postgres blog was not where I needed to blog. I needed to blog for my movable type-based Pioneer Press blog. But again, Postgres, you know, has an elegant solution for that, because Postgres will take your content, and if you've set up the account the right way, it'll redirect everything to other destinations, to Twitter, to Facebook, or, you know, to another blog. So I could, you know, very easily, very comfortably compose, post to Postgres. Postgres would automatically forward it on to my work blog. And so just using the email application on the iPad, I could do a lot of very powerful, very extensive blogging without feeling any pain whatsoever. So those are two examples of, you know, how I encountered problems that were created by the iPad's inherent limitations, and sort of found ways around them that were very satisfactory. So you have to make some adjustments when using the iPad, but in many cases, these problems are eminently solvable.
Well, I, on the other hand, when I hear you talk about that, and I think of my mother using this, not that she blogs or works for a newspaper, but sort of I think of her as kind of the common folk who are now adopting the iPad, and it still seems to me that syncing and moving stuff off the device into the world is still a big problem, because even though you and I understand how to use this, to use Dropbox and Goodreader and some of these other services, when it comes to normal folks who say, well, I just need to get this from here to here, and is email the only avenue? And it seems to me that this is still a problem waiting for a very simple solution, and ideally that one comes from Apple.
Yeah, I mean, it's still kind of early in the game, and there are, like, even as a tech nerd, I have my moments of frustration where I just want to throw the iPad out the window and scurry back to the comfortable, you know, Macintosh environment. I have those moments, and make no mistake, I'm not advocating the iPad as a full-time 100% replacement for the laptop. I mean, the laptop has a very important place in my life. But the iPad for certain people you know, solves problems. It's less of a hassle to carry. It's more streamlined and easier to use. And all of that is, you know, is very important for some people. There's an example. One of my favorite case studies in my book, which is in fact a whole series of case studies on iPad use in large companies, small companies, educational institutions. One of my favorite examples is an attorney who doesn't spend a lot of time in his office. He'll poke his head into the offices of colleagues and see them, like, hiding behind, you know, huge piles of paper. And he says, well, that's, you know, that's fine, but that isn't for me. I don't want any paper. I don't want to be in my office. He'll visit his clients. His clients tend to be Mac using artist type, so he's sort of an attorney to the Mac head sort of a guy. But my point is, he spends his day visiting his clients, and then between client visits, he'll pop into a Starbucks, sit down, open the iPad, and get to work. And he's one of those people that has absolutely no problem with a virtual keyboard. Some people have a problem with a virtual keyboard. I, for instance, don't find it to be a satisfactory replacement for a physical keyboard. He is one of those people who has absolutely no problem. He opens the iPad, you know, puts it at an angle with the Apple case, gets to work and he has absolutely no problem. I ran into example after example of people like that who don't feel constrained by the iPad and find themselves being massively productive. Not everyone is like that, and the iPad isn't, you know, right for everyone in a productivity sense. For some people, just sort of consuming content, you know, videos or whatnot is the best use case. But there are the iPad is a good fit in a productivity sense for a lot of people, and I ran into many people like that.
Good. Well, I was actually going to ask you for a couple of other examples. So, what kind of people did you find who found ways to use it that you found unexpected?
Like for instance, I interviewed a realtor who she does a lot of work in Pages and Keynote on the Mac, and that she was going on a personal trip. There was some work that she needed to get done, and so since it was a personal trip, she didn't want to lug her laptop along, but she was taking her iPad anyway because she was going to use it for personal pleasure. But she had these outstanding duties, and so she described to me in some detail how on the train, you know, she would take some of the templates and some of the flyers and so forth that she had already created on the Mac, and she found to her great surprise that that she could very easily use the iPad as a laptop replacement in using Apple's apps. So that's another example. And I just time and time again, I just ran into people like that. She however, you know, found a little discomfort with the virtual keyboard. She prefers a physical keyboard. So, you know, there are people like that. When I went on my business trip, I could not really be productive on the virtual keyboard. When I was sitting in the keynote, you know, Steve Jobs was giving his keynote, and I had the iPad on my lap, and I could not use a physical keyboard. That would have been awkward. So I had the iPad on my lap, and I had to, you know, type tweets. I felt a little pain. I didn't really like that. When I was in Panera, I would, you know, automatically, you know, stand the iPad up vertically, pull out the keyboard, get to work. That's my comfort zone. Other people, you know, don't really need the physical keyboard.
Also, I'm noticing that now some case manufacturers are starting to come out with cases that have built-in keyboards. So you're sort of creating this little laptop that's much lighter and yet still has the touch interface.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think one of the nicest ones is the Zagmate, I think it's called. Mm-hmm. There's two versions of the Zagmate. One is just a case that morphs into a stand when you're using the iPad. The other one is a case that morphs into a stand and a keyboard. The keyboard is sort of integrated. A buddy of mine bought one and showed it to me at Chipotle the other day, and I find that very interesting. Those devices aren't for me because I find, you know, when you sort of glam all these pieces together, you create kind of a bulky kind of a thing. I like to keep things modular. I like to have the iPad, the keyboard separate from the tablet. I carry this little, it's called 3 Feet. It's a very unusual name, 3 Feet. It's this little stand. It's a little hard to describe it. It folds and interlocks in different ways so that you can put your iPad in different positions. It's very stable, even though it's very small. So I have one of those in my backpack. I have an Apple wireless keyboard in my backpack. I throw the iPad in there, and then, you know, sort of depending on the circumstances, I can sort of pull out, you know, the various pieces and use them in different ways. And so I like the modular approach. And very often I'll just want to use the iPad by itself, and it's nice in such a situation to sort of forget about the keyboard is even around.
Right. So what apps would you suggest for those who want to use their iPad in a business environment?
The big ones for me, you know, I mentioned that the iPad could not sync with Google Docs at the time. Since then, a number of things have changed. You can edit Google Docs in the browser, but perhaps better option are a number of office-like suites for the iPads, just QuickOffice and Docs2Go, which sort of very elegantly sync with Google Docs and other services like MobileMe. Mm-hmm. And so I've become fond of those. QuickOffice is my favorite. LogMeIn Ignition is amazing. I'll tell you a little story that's in my book. I was at my kids' soccer practice one summer day, and I had a moment of panic because I realized there was a problem, a work-related problem I needed to solve. I don't remember what it was exactly, but I I needed to get this uncertainty, this moment. I needed to solve a problem, essentially, and the way to do that was to see some information that was on my computer. But I was on the, I was sitting on the bleachers, you know, far from my office computer. But then I realized Log Me In Ignition is part of the Log Me In remote access infrastructure environment, and I tapped Log Me In, logged into my computer at work, solved my problem, realized that, you know, everything was okay, stuck the iPad, you know, back in a backpack, and that happened sort of very early in the game, early in my research for the book. And it was sort of an epiphany. It was sort of, you know, the final confirmation that this tablet, which many people regard as a pleasure device, that this tablet could do some very powerful work-related things. It was amazing to sort of use your finger as the mouse cursor and it just navigate a Windows desktop, you know, from afar using the 3G connection. That really, really amazed me. Dropbox, you know, obviously Dropbox. Square, have you heard of Square? Square is a fantastic service where you set up an account that essentially lets you use your iPad as a cash register. Here at the Pioneer Press, I'm the keeper of the swag room. The swag room is, you know, all the swag that comes into the office that never gets reviewed and just kind of sits around. This accumulates in this room of which I am the official minder. And then once a year, we have this big swag sale where we sell everything off to staffers with all proceeds going to charity. Mm-hmm. And in the past, when I held these sales, you know, it was check or cash. I could not obviously take credit cards. But with Square now, I could fire up the Square interface on my iPad, attach a little card swiper, or just do everything right on the screen. Have people punch in people's credit card information, have them sign with their fingertips, consummate a transaction, have a receipt sent to their email address. And so the last swag sale was the bulk of the transactions were credit card based. Really amazing stuff. I was just sitting there like saying, man, this is cool. And everybody else was saying, man, this is cool. It was just, it was really amazing. So
I can hear the excitement in your voice over processing credit cards.
We live in the future.
Yes, we do. Yeah. Okay. Well, speaking of the future, you spent a lot of time covering Apple and you're aware of its efforts across the board. So do you think that the iPad is a strategy that's separate from the laptop, or do you think this is a hint of the future of mobile computing, one where the iPad and the MacBook eventually become a single device?
I don't think that would happen, and I really hope it does not happen because laptops obviously fit within a business environment very nicely. They have, you know, forever. iPads are also being embraced by businesses, but in different ways. The iPad is a wonderful business tool in the sense of like people in meetings sort of handing the iPad back and forth and showing each other information for people that are standing up and consulting information. I talked to an architectural firm that has people out in the field and they're carrying their iPads and they're using Dropbox or Box.net to access all their information. And so there are case uses for each of these devices that are very different. And so I don't anticipate that there will be a grand coalescing or merging of the devices because both kinds of devices, in my opinion, are very important. They, however, will acquire elements of each other. You know, they will resemble each other more and more as they sort of there's a symbiosis. They're feeding off each other. And so they will sort of absorb, you know, the best features of each other. But I think, and I hope they'll remain separate. I'm not sure I answered your question.
Well, no, it is because we're looking at the next version of OS X, Lion, which will have more touch interface elements built in that have come from the iOS experience. And I'm just wondering how far Apple's going to take that. Is this simply where they're going to find elements that work for both and integrate them? Or are they really looking forward to saying, you know, the Mac is eventually going to be this kind of device and this kind of device is going to be more like a Mac. And now we've got this one thing instead of maintaining two separate product categories.
Yeah, I, I don't see that happen, although, you know, some very interesting things are happening in the Mac space. More and more apps are integrating swiping interface capabilities. More and more apps are sort of are nudging people towards touchpads or the external Magic Trackpad and saying, you use this. This is the best way to use our app. Forget about the mouse. In fact, a lot of applications, Reader comes to mind, Twitterific, the new version of Twitterific come to mind, are in fact mouse unfriendly. They're harder to use with a mouse than with a keyboard or a trackpad. That annoys me greatly because I like the mouse. But we're sort of moving into a direction, into a future where apparently the mouse is becoming, you know, more and more irrelevant. That troubles me because, again, I like the mouse, but that's kind of where we're heading. The Mac App Store, very similar to the iOS App Store. The Mac App Store, you know, I'm an old school Mac guy who says, you know, grumble. I like, you know, the old way of installing software. But, you know, I had a little epiphany the other day where Twitterific, the new version of Twitterific 4, came out initially not on the Mac App Store. It came out on the maker's website, and I found myself realizing that I could buy it there, but I went back to see if it was on the Mac App Store. It wasn't, and so I very reluctantly purchased it the regular way. But then but then when it popped up on the Mac App Store, I said to myself, I want to buy it this way because then all those updates, you know, will be automatically pushed to me. So I literally bought it again. And I Steve Jobs is apparently is holding my hand and sort of leading me to this future where the Mac App Store increasingly is going to be sort of be the way to buy apps. And, you know, the old Mac guy in me feels a little trepidation, but the convenience and the elegance and the simplicity is quite compelling.
Well, that's the thing, is that it's interesting how quickly you get used to certain ways of doing things. My daughter, for example, the other day she was using my laptop and she tapped on the screen because she wanted to move an object on the screen by tapping on it. I said, no, honey, this is a laptop. You can't do that.
Well, I have a little confession for you. The other day I was using my MacBook Air and I tapped on the screen. Mm-hmm. I do that. You know, I'll be using an iPad for much of the day, and then I'll switch to a laptop, and my muscle memory from the iPad use remains, and I keep trying to frantically tap the screen, and nothing happens. So I sympathize with your daughter because I run into that situation myself.
Yeah. Okay, so wrapping up, where can listeners go to read your work and pick up a copy of your book?
Well, the book's website is it's a slightly unusual URL. It's iPadMeans.biz. That's iPadMeans.biz. That's the book's website. If you want to find my work, my Pioneer Press related work, that's at yourtechweblog.com. That'll lead you where you need to go. And the book website has a buy area where it sort of outlines, you know, the various physical and digital ways to buy the book. There are a lot of options.
Right. It's also on the iBook store. I checked just before I spoke with you, and there it is.
It is on the iBook store. And if you buy a PDF from the publisher, that's another iPad-friendly option because that PDF has been very carefully formatted for iPad use. So that's another option.
Well, there you go. Again, the book title is iPad Means Business, How Apple's Tablet Computer is Changing the Work World. I've read the book. I've actually written a blurb for it. It's very good. It's absolutely worth your time reading it. So thank you very much for joining me, Julio.
Well, thanks for the praise. I appreciate that since I respect you so much.
And that wraps up this edition of the Macworld Podcast. I'd like to thank David Chartier, Julio Ojeda Zapata, and, of course, you for listening. If you have any comments or questions, feel free to drop us a line at podcast@macworld.com. Or you can leave us a voicemail at 415-520-9761. This is Chris Breen reminding you that you can find more Apple, macOS, iOS, and technology news, views, and information at macworld.com. Thanks very much for listening. See you around.